WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Can you believe another week has gone by? It's time for our weekly news recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
It's all about dignity, giving a person an opportunity to slow down.
Chicago officials want to modernize homeless shelters in the city with $40 million in infrastructure and private space improvements.
Reports of a man with a knife in the lobby sending the Dirksen Federal Courthouse into a lockdown.
We finally get people to get back on our public transportation system, and then they can't have a pleasant ride because someone wants to smoke.
Michael McLean once was among Madigan's closest strategic advisors. Now, McLean could face nearly 6 years in prison.
Block Club Chicago reporter Mac Lederman joined me, as well as Chicago Sun-Times federal courts reporter John Seidel and WBEZ investigative reporter Dan Mihalopoulos. Two sentences were handed down this week in one of the biggest bribery scandals in Illinois history. John started us off by telling us about former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan's right-hand man.
Michael McLean, who was sentenced yesterday to 2 years in prison for his key role in this long-running ComEd conspiracy that was aimed for
2 years.
He wound up with 2 years. Prosecutors originally asked for almost six, but there was kind of an interesting moment yesterday at the hearing where they brought that down to a three-year recommendation. Mm. And Judge Shaw wound up giving him two. They did that because we've been seeing these sentencings finally play out. Mike McLean got 2 years. Ann Promajori, the former ComEd CEO, she got 2 years. Mm-hmm. John Hooker, a third defendant, got 18 months. As these sentences have been coming down, the prosecutors are kind of acknowledging the potential disparity here, and they adjusted. They also adjusted because Mike McLean has serious health issues, and his attorney argued to the judge that prison is going to be extremely difficult for him.
Mm. Yeah, so Mike McLean and his longtime relationship with Mike Madigan, maybe take us back and remind us what he's actually going to prison for.
Sure. So what he's going to prison for is because he played a role in arranging this scheme in which ComEd paid, it was $1.3 million over 8 years to five allies of Mike Madigan. And the point was, if you pay off these allies of Madigan, that Madigan would be more positively disposed to ComEd's legislation in Springfield, which is crucial to ComEd. And they hid this money through, they funneled it through third-party firms, and the people who were getting this money did hardly any work for ComEd. So that was the general scheme. Michael McLean, though, was a key part of this because he's got this long relationship with Michael Madigan that goes all the way back to the 1970s when they served in the Illinois House together.
Oh, long time.
And, you know, McLean served for about 10 years. I believe he lost an election, and then he moved on to lobbying while Madigan stayed and became this very powerful House Speaker. But because of this close relationship, McLean kind of developed this reputation, earned or not, and that's been debated in courtrooms, as just kind of Madigan's messenger and his emissary. And there was this understanding in Springfield that whatever Michael McLean said, he was speaking for the Speaker.
Yeah. Anyone surprised at the table of these two-year sentences, or is this pretty much what you were expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I think given the spot that McLean was in, I mean, Madigan's at the top of the pyramid, right? Mm-hmm. And he got a much longer sentence. But McLean, you know, could have cooperated. We encountered him when he was under investigation, when it was well known that he was facing federal heat. We encountered him, Dave McKinney, another WBZ reporter, and I, several years ago. You know, before he was charged outside Chicago Cut Steakhouse, rather famously stopped and talked to us and said that they were pressuring him to flip, but he would not betray Mike Madigan. And now He's paying the price for that. I don't know what he would have done 5 and 6 years ago when he was first facing the federal heat had he known that it would come to this. But certainly he's been around Springfield and Illinois politics. He's from Quincy, Illinois, originally. It was very close to Mike Madigan, though, I think indisputably. When you look at a guy like Mike Madigan, who's famously sort of tight-lipped and almost monastic in his approach to what he does. Mike McLean was a guy that, you know, they traveled overseas with their wives together, and he was a presence in his office. He may not have been known publicly that well, but, you know, ended up playing really a double role as both a lobbyist for ComEd and somebody who considered privately, as we found out in everything that surfaced in this case, considered Madigan to be client number one.
Yeah.
So this is where that brought him.
Yeah, interesting. You know, so 2 years for Mike McLean, 2 years for Anne Pramaggiore. Anything else you can share, John, that the judge said about these sentencings?
Sure. So Judge Manischaw, he inherited this. He didn't preside over the trial, but the judge who did preside over it passed in 2024. And Judge Shaw has, you know, to a certain degree has found himself repeating himself in these sentencing hearings because there's just a lot of the same issues. Some themes that we've heard from him is that even though bribery counts were tossed out in this case because of a Supreme Court ruling last year, the judge believes there was bribery at play here. He believes that a reasonable jury could have found. And in fact, he believes that, you know, that the crimes that remain, falsifying books and records, was basically a method for bribery.
Yeah.
And he said that it's, you know, despite Michael McLean's medical issues, it's important to accept and acknowledge that this was corruption and there should be a price to pay for that.
I mean, Illinois is known, let's be real here, for its political scandal. So I'm curious, Mac, Dan, where do you think this one ranks in our state's political hall of fame?
I mean, it's tough for me, for a guy who never lived through the Madigan era like these two distinguished gentlemen next to me. And I guess that's really a question I have for you, John. When I go around as a neighborhood reporter talking to people around that 13th ward where Michael Madigan really ruled with the iron fist, it seems like opinions about him are very solidified. You know, as long as the grass is mowed and the snow is removed, people are happy. There just seems to be kind of this destigmatization to corruption. I mean, do you feel that? Do you think this trial has changed the way people think about Michael Madigan?
I think it has to a degree, and will. I mean, I think this is going to be in the first line of his obituary, but you're right. I mean, and that's a theme that I feel like Dan would, I think, probably agree. That's that we've heard about politicians in town for a very long time, you know, like keep the trains running on time, whatever else, make sure the city's running and all is well. And, you know, there's also an argument. Michael Madigan insists on his innocence despite the verdict. Michael McLean insists on his innocence. They feel very strongly that they didn't commit crimes here. And I'm sure their supporters, including in that ward and in that district, feel the same way. So.
Yeah, but we also have to look at the whole state. I mean, those are neighborhoods that have benefited the most from having a powerful politician coming from their neighborhood. They're going to bring home the bacon. But in terms to, you know, to answer your question, which I think is an excellent one, I think this one ranks way up there when you consider that Mike Madigan's the longest serving speaker in the history of the United States, right, was the head of the Democratic Party as it came to dominate the state. There was only a short period he lost the speakership and when the party lost the House, but that was decades ago. When you consider his power, I think it ranks up there with the Blagojevich scandal, absolutely, and the governors that have gone to prison. I think he certainly had that sort of stature over decades where he was certainly an equal of the governors or really had a role in that branch of government that really was a balance to the executive power in Springfield. So, yeah, given his stature, I think this ranks up there very, very high.
Sure.
So 83-year-old Madigan is supposed to begin his 7.5-year sentence in October, right?
Correct.
On the 13th?
13th, yep.
So let's turn now to some news out of City Hall. And now I'm looking at you, Mac, because
okay, I'm here.
Chicago's taken a major step in trying to end homelessness. What is Mayor Brandon Johnson proposing right now?
So $40 million is the number here, Sasha, and that's going to go to improve conditions at 7 city shelters, 5 of them being on the west side of Chicago, which has the most need, I believe. And this is part of more of a larger scale plan by the Johnson administration to create a one shelter initiative, taking the 25 plus migrant shelters that were stood up during the flood of people we saw coming to Chicago. a while back, and really combining it with pre-existing services for the city's homeless populations, which, as we know, has been here for a really long time. Only two of those migrant shelters are still remain, Sasha, the American Islamic Center and one by Midway Airport. Because the need has really died down since we saw that wave of people coming from Texas across the border.
Yeah, a lot of them have been given housing.
Yeah, and that's why we've been able to kind of move into this next stage of this project they're envisioning. And this $40 million will be used to take these seven shelters and take them from congregate settings, so people sharing rooms together, to non-congregate settings, which everyone, you know, gets their own cot in a room without having to have a roommate. Mm. If you talk to housing advocates, they say this is a major crucial linchpin to really combating the city's homelessness problem, because a major problem outreach workers face is that people don't really want to go inside to share a room with somebody else. So they say that if you can create non-congregate settings, give people room and a sense of dignity, that will be able to start them on the path to maybe getting a job or getting clean. So this will create more attractive options for people
across
the city.
That's such an important detail that I think, you know, folks can end up glossing over, right? Because these more than 350 people that are expected to be housed here will have, should have private sleeping rooms and bathrooms. And it sounds like they're going to get some secure storage to put their personal belongings as well. And Johnson's really touting this as the largest shelter capital investment in our city's history. So it'd be definitely one to watch. The neighborhoods, Mac, that this would be in?
Ooh, I gotta look it up. Let's see.
I'm hearing five of the seven will be on the west side.
I'm seeing right here East Garfield Park, West Garfield Park, Uptown, and Englewood. Shouts out to Michael Libtrot, who reported this story for Block Club.
Yeah. $40 million, John Seidel, half of it. So $20 million is actually federal funds. You think Chicago can realistically count on federal funding right now, though?
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily take it to the bank. You know, I mean, hopefully, I mean, if it's been allocated, I mean, you gotta make plans. But I think, you know, based on what we've seen, and we just saw the clawback for federal funding for public broadcasting. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think, you know, hopefully some people are making plans for what happens if things are clawed back. But, you know, we'll see.
While the mayor is unveiling this massive investment to help solve homelessness, the city's actually potentially facing a bill in the hundreds of millions of dollars regarding police overtime. Dan, what should we know?
Yeah, I just did a story about some recent court filings in a very long-running case. It's a 10-year-old case. A few cops filed a lawsuit on behalf of what turns out to be 8,500 current and retired cops who say that They've been owed overtime for work that they did many, many years ago because the city miscalculated it. And the courts, actually, federal court, ruled in favor of the cops in 2020. So we're going on 5 years, and they're still fighting in court, the city and the plaintiffs, over how much the city owes. The city recently had a filing that said that they owe no more than $195 million, which is a significant chunk in and of itself. Mm-hmm. The estimates, depending on how you calculate it from the plaintiffs, range from somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million to nearly $450 million. And it, you know, interest compounds on these sorts of things because the city keeps kicking the can, and the plaintiffs are like, well, if it weren't cops, if it were teachers or somebody else that was owed this kind of money, we would have been paid by now. This is stretched over three administrations. Rahm Emanuel was mayor when it was filed. Mm-hmm. Lori Lightfoot, I believe, was mayor when the ruling came against the city. And now we have Brandon Johnson, who also has not brought this to a conclusion. The city and their lawyers deny that they're delaying this, but the city won't comment. And I don't think I've heard the mayor, the current mayor, Brandon Johnson, say if they plan to bring this to a conclusion, because it's really hard to get a grip on your overall financial situation when you could be facing a bill of $200, $300, $400 million plus dollars.
Mm. Let's pivot from City Hall and go back to the Dirksen Federal Courthouse, just a few blocks away. You spend a lot of time there, John, right? No secrets there. What happened this past Tuesday?
On Tuesday, the emergency lights started going off, and there was an announcement over the loudspeaker about a situation in the lobby that led to a lockdown of the building that went on for about 9 hours. There was a man in the lobby with a knife threatening suicide.
Wow.
Like I said, prompted that lockdown. It started a little before 11 o'clock, and things continued on until about two or three, and I was among many people watching from the cafeteria windows as police gathered around the building.
They did you know in real time what was going on, or is this info
like
that you
I said,
had to find
I mean,
out?
The first indication that I had is when those lights went off, and they made an announcement, and then I was getting information from colleagues like Tom Shuba at the Sun-Times and Rose Sobel, who were hearing about the man with the knife.
Yeah.
We were watching outside as they cleared Federal Plaza and there was a drone flying overhead. Now, around 2 o'clock or so, they started giving people guidance of how they could exit the building if they wanted to, because of course they'd have to go through the lobby where this man was.
Right.
And I was not among those who left at that point. And a short time later, we were told it was a mandatory floor by floor evacuation. So I was among those who was led down I went down a southern elevator and then through some doors out of the east side of the lobby and then toward State Street. And this finally ended around 8 o'clock, I think, Tuesday night. My understanding from a colleague who was watching at that point was that SWAT went in. U.S. Marshals or other officials managed to take him down and brought him out. We've been watching to see if there are going to be charges against him. Last I checked, they hadn't been filed.
Nothing yet.
Yeah.
Well, very tense times, but I'm glad everybody came out.
Yeah,
okay.
As far as there were no reports of injury, except the man who was in the lobby was taken to the hospital. We didn't get a clarification immediately why he had to be.
Right.
But no other injuries that I had heard about.
So, John, we were talking about sentencing in the ComEd case there, but that wasn't the only sentence that was handed down involving politicians and bribes this week.
Right.
So I want you to tell us more about Southwest Suburban Worth Township Supervisor John O'Sullivan.
So John O'Sullivan was caught up in a separate corruption investigation. It was another one of those that made headlines all those years back. He actually pleaded guilty in 2021 to conspiring to pay off a trustee in Oak Lawn. And also involved in this was Patrick Doherty, who I believe was chief of staff to Cook County Commissioner Jeff Tobolsky, also facing sentencing soon. And Omar Mani, who was a red light camera exec who cooperated with the feds and has testified in a recent trial. But John O'Sullivan faced sentencing on, I think it was Wednesday, and wound up with 18 months of probation. And prosecutors actually asked for that lighter sentence for him because they said he cooperated very quickly. He provided information about Doherty and others, helped secure a plea agreement against Doherty, who's in prison now, at least was on Wednesday when I checked on him. And, Doherty was, he admitted to many corruption schemes, not just this one with Oak Lawn.
Yeah.
Prosecutors said, and I don't really hear them say this very often, they said when it came to John O'Sullivan, this is all he did. He wasn't involved in any other crimes. He kind of had like a moment here where, according to his defense attorney, he'd be happy to help people's kids get jobs. So what happened was this Oak Lawn trustee was unemployed. His son was looking for a summer job. He asked John O'Sullivan for help. John O'Sullivan, I think he was looking at a construction job, but also went to Patrick Doherty.
Okay.
But both O'Sullivan and Patrick Doherty were working for this red light camera company called SafeSpeed, which was already in Oak Lawn but wanted to expand its footprint there. They wanted more red light cameras in Oak Lawn. So Doherty thought, and O'Sullivan has acknowledged that this was his motivation too, if they helped the Oak Lawn trustee's son get a job, the Oak Lawn trustee might be inclined to help SafeSpeed get more cameras there. So again, O'Sullivan admitted that this was his motivation in doing so, but his attorney also said he would have helped anybody's son if they had come to him looking for help. And again, prosecutors said this was all they found. He was very helpful. And so Judge LaShonda Hunt agreed to go along with that 18-month probation sentence.
You've been paying attention to this too, Dan.
Yeah, because I did a column on him. I just looked it up back in 2017 for the Sun-Times. Johnny O is what they call him. And, you know, he's just like one of these guys that has had jobs at various levels of local government. I think Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle got, you know, rid of him at one point. He got back on the county payroll working with Ed Moody. And although all this red light camera stuff is separate from the Madigan / ComEd scandal, Johnny O worked at one time for a Cook County commissioner named Ed Moody, who, by the way, was one of those ghost subcontractors involved in the whole Madigan scandal. He's a very close Madigan ally. So, you know, the old timers used to say when I started out in newspapers here 25 years ago, it's all one story and there's always some
definitely
connection.
Overlap, you know, here, yeah.
Like, this guy is one of those like a Kevin Bacon of of Chicago and Cook County politics. You know,
that's the second time you've mentioned bacon so far.
Yes, oh, that's right.
Bring home the bacon and Kevin Bacon.
That's right. That's right. Let's turn to something different, Mac. Block Club reported on two alarming incidents involving ICE. I want to start with the one with Catalina Moda Martinez. She lives in the far northwest side Montclair neighborhood, so near Harlem and Belmont.
Yeah, so last Thursday, Catalina Mota Martinez claimed to be driving home when two federal agents approached her car outside her Montclair home on the northwest side of the city. She began recording the interaction, refused to roll down her window, and somewhere in the film, one of the officers puts his hand over her windshield and over the camera so they can't be seen.
Goodness.
What happens next is not captured on video, but family members and community organizers that are supporting her say that the two agents busted her window open and arrested her, and she was transferred to a jail in Indiana, which is a common tactic that we're seeing given that Illinois state law does not allow ICE to rent beds for detainees. So mm-hmm. often they're taken to a staging area of sorts in Indiana and shipped off elsewhere. Catalina Mota Martinez, by every account of it, was an upstanding citizen of Chicago. She lived here for over 30 years, more than half her life, and she ran a Tupperware company in. We all need Tupperware, Sasha. So
yeah,
it's looks like it's unclear where she'll be taken from here. What really was the reason that she was detained in the first place?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. And earlier that same day, ICE agents stopped a car in the largely Mexican neighborhood of Little Village. So what have your colleagues learned about that incident?
A very similar tactic in that incident: of federal agents approaching a car with two men in it, arresting and detaining both of them, and transferring them to a jail or prison in Indiana. And we're seeing a lot of this given that it's been widely reported nationally that ICE can't meet the federal mandate set by the Trump administration to arrest people. I believe their goal was to arrest 3,000 people a day. But detaining people, finding them, processing them is a process that is very difficult. So it seems like all that these federal agents can really do is these fear tactics of taking people out of their neighborhoods. But it's increasingly hard in Chicago given just the community support around these instances. They're very highly documented. There's organizations helping these people out, talking about it to the press in a way that sort of plays into the hands of federal agents, because every time they're doing something like this, it's being broadcasted out into the world. And their goal is to make sure people self-deport, that they read these kinds of stories and hear about it, and they worry about being next, and they take the steps to leave themselves. So really they're doing what they can, and it's upending people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the city council is on summer break right now, but before they went on vacation, they were urging legislators to take action to actually unmask these immigration agents. Dan, fill us in.
Yeah, real quick. On last Wednesday, two city council members, Michael Rodriguez from the 22nd Ward and Andre Vasquez from the 40th Ward, introduced a resolution urging state legislators to pass laws banning federal agents from wearing masks, and it urges the lawmakers to require that federal agents wear appropriate uniforms and identify themselves. We're seeing all this on social media, in videos. Of course, on the other side, you know, they talk about ICE agents being doxxed and being targeted personally. But this resolution in the city council is co-sponsored by Mayor Brandon Johnson and 18 members of the city council. At the state level, with Attorney General Kwame Raoul has done a similar thing. He's joined 20 other attorneys general in a letter this week urging Congress to pass legislation banning ICE agents from wearing masks. Mm-hmm. You know, given the majority in both houses of Congress, you know, and the support for the president's, you know, agenda, which is heavily pushing deportation, you know, I don't think Stephen Miller's going to let that one get through Capitol Hill, but.
Yeah, you know, and good point here. Members of Congress, including, you know, seven Illinois House representatives, introduced that bill late last month banning ICE agents from wearing face masks. But given, John, that it's a Republican-controlled Congress, what do you think is the likelihood of anything like that actually passing?
I mean, I agree with Dan. I think there's very little chance. And not only are they pushing deportation, I mean, I'm sure that it would be kind of seen as an anti-law enforcement move, right? Yeah. I mean, it's the party line is the party of law and order and supporting law enforcement. And I think that would be a real surprise move for them.
More news out of Little Village, Mac. What did residents there wake up to Saturday morning?
Four businesses were vandalized with swastikas and pro-ICE messages on a few of them. These are largely community organizations that are supporting migrants either in the city or through the legal process.
Mm-hmm. Latinos Progresando was one.
Yeah, they were the main people speaking out of this, and they have been an organization that has been helping people in their court cases at the federal immigration hearings. As we've seen across the country, ICE agents have been found waiting outside these hearings, looking to catch people where they know they will be. So this organization has been fighting back on this. They've been shielding people. They've been getting them legal help. And now they're saying that they're being targeted because of that. Mm.
So presidential actions are impacting us here locally in Chicago and Illinois in other ways, including at the University of Chicago. Dan, they got some information requests from the federal government this week. What was that about?
Yeah, the University of Chicago has, which I think goes now by UChicago, has disclosed that the federal government requested information on UChicago's admissions practices and international students, and about a third of the university's student body is made up of international students. So that could be potentially significant. We've seen a lot of concern because of immigration practices, primarily with regard to international students at many universities, and some of the universities that have the largest international student populations are here, not just University of Chicago, but also the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. There was a good story in the New York Times just recently about the Chinatown that has sprung up in Champaign-Urbana. Because of the huge population, that the food there is as good as anything in China, and the concern that they have, because these universities, which are public, in the case of University of Illinois, unlike UChicago, University of Illinois is a public university, and that's revenue that's going into the public coffers. You know that, and for those of us who might want to send our kids to state university, this could severely affect the finances of private and public universities.
Now, speaking of UChicago, Mac, you covered how presidential actions are impacting the UChicago hospital.
Yeah, so UChicago is the latest to fall here of cutting back their gender-affirming care for minors. This can include gender-affirming surgeries or puberty blockers, hormone therapies given to people who feel their gender identity at birth doesn't match who they actually are. And we've seen places like this fold previously back in February.
Yeah.
Lurie's Children's Hospital.
Yeah, Lurie was first, right?
Yeah, it was believed to be the first to step out here on giving gender-affirming surgeries. UI Health that same month canceled a gender-affirming surgery for a trans 17-year-old who had been going to them for services for 3 years and counting. That drew protests. This is drawing another round of protests. And I believe we're seeing a second wave of these local hospitals canceling gender-affirming care for minors because the federal walls are caving in a bit. We had the Supreme Court recently freeze a judge's abilities to stop national injunctions, national executive orders by Trump. And one of those executive orders was to cut federal funding for medical practices that offer gender-affirming care for minors. So these research hospitals in Chicago, like UChicago, like Rush, they rely on millions of dollars in federal funding for research, and many of their patients are on Medicare and Medicaid. The federal government would usually reimburses these hospitals for caring for those types of patients. There's a fear that that may go away. So I think the calculus by many of these places is we need to, save everybody who's we service here, and that comes to, tamper our services for a very small population of people that is trans youth. We're going to do it, but at the same time, we have people out there protesting, saying, "Hey, we're not the city that's going to bow down to bullies." There's no clear indication that Trump can actually do this.
Yeah, I mean, is anyone else getting whiplash just from all, not just the barrage of federal cuts that have been coming down the pike since January, but just like the trickle down effect, right? Then what businesses have to do, the services they have to remove in order to like keep the bottom line going. Is anyone else just alarmed by all of this?
I mean, it's of a piece of, of what we're seeing being done to law firms, being done to universities, and to public media.
Absolutely. We're living it.
And I'll just add, it's coming for, some of the most vulnerable people in our society. Something I heard from trans rights advocates is that they feel like trans kids are being used as a bargaining chip for the federal government to assert more control on our local institutions that keep Chicago. And this is in some ways the cover they're using to do that.
Yeah. definitely certain communities being targeted more than others. Absolutely. The Justice Department is also being impacted by White House directives, John. We've seen this influence picks for U.S. attorneys, haven't we?
Yeah, it's we're seeing kind of a new phenomenon with U.S. attorneys, including here in Chicago. So, you know, the traditional process is the president will nominate a U.S. attorney, the Senate will confirm. And to be clear, I was just looking this morning, Donald Trump is nominating people to be U.S. attorneys, but they're not really moving through the Senate very fast. I don't think any have been confirmed yet. Instead, what we're seeing is his attorney general is appointing interim U.S. attorneys across the country, including in Chicago. April 7th, Andrew Boutros took office as the interim U.S. attorney here. Under the law, those interim U.S. attorneys only have 4 months to serve, and at that point, the federal judges, the courts, get to appoint a U.S. attorney. And for the most part, we've been seeing them kind of just rubber stamp the people that the Trump administration have been putting in place.
Right.
And actually, just yesterday, Chief Judge Kendall here in Chicago entered an order that said that the judges here had approved the appointment of Andrew Boutros. So Andrew Boutros is now the U.S. attorney on a permanent basis, on a court-appointed basis.
Right.
But there are some differences. You know, I've kind of explored this with some experts earlier this year. And there's, for example, there's questions about who could remove a court-appointed U.S. attorney. I mean, it's an open question. We've seen kind of controversy play out with it before. Unclear if even the president has the power to. I mean, withstanding pressure from the president,
you know, that would have been my follow-up.
Right? Yeah.
But we have a president. But we have a president where, whether it's his jurisdiction or not, he will make the move to try to change things.
And there's going to be quite a bit of pressure to withstand that. But the point is, like, this is kind of like a new phenomenon. I think that one of the experts I spoke to earlier this year was, I was kind of talking about the possibility of this happening. She pointed out, well, it usually doesn't get to that. It usually doesn't get to the point where the courts are appointing U.S. attorney. But now I've just been watching across the country in jurisdiction after jurisdiction, these courts are appointing these U.S. attorneys.
Now, I want to turn to what many of us were talking about this week, at least in the middle of the week, the heat. We had a heat advisory on Wednesday and Thursday. Plenty of people turned up their air conditioning as a result. Some of them, though, they got sticker shock from those electricity bills, John. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, bills are going up. It's bad news.
That's it. End of story.
Shout out to Robert Chanik at the Trib who kind of documented this. But so my understanding is that we're seeing electricity bills from ComEd going up month to month, I think on average about $68 on the June 30th bill.
Ooh, and oh, some, dear.
Right. And
that's
some
steep.
Some people actually saw triple-digit increases, as I understand it. And a lot of, you know, there are two main reasons for this, that, mm-hmm. at least that are being cited. And one of them is just the heat, right? Like you said, I mean, people are cranking up their ACs. It's real bad. It's hard to kind of like weather this.
Yeah, even at home, I'm unapologetically turning everything on, AC plus the fan. Even if that doesn't make sense, I'm like, I need all the air.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it's costing you. And then there's also this issue of these audits, you know, and there's a capacity audit that I guess happens every year. That has also increased the rates. And so between that and turning up the air conditioning, the bills are going up. And unfortunately, the bad news is I think we're expecting this to just continue. So,
great.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. Appreciate you.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Another way folks are dealing with the heat, Dan, is they're heading to the lake or their neighborhood public pool. So our beaches and Chicago Park District pools fully staffed this year. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it seems so. I mean, this is the first time since before the pandemic, as some of our colleagues at the Sun-Times pointed out, did some requests and found out this is the first time that they're going to be open 7 days a week this summer since before the pandemic that, you know, they had closed the beaches entirely and the pools as well during that time. And it's kind of gradually, there have been staffing issues over the years for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
People that worked there, particularly young women, were treated very poorly, even criminally. Then there's just a shortage nationally of lifeguards around the country. But this year they seem to have done well enough. Although, you know, one of the lifeguards over at Douglas Park shot two patrons recently, killed one. It was last month.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one in critical condition last we checked. So, there's some questions about whether proper vetting was done there. They say they couldn't have avoided that situation, but the man had a number of incidents, and the charges against him are pending. He said it was self-defense. So, Yeah, there are, the pools and beaches are open, but it has not been a controversy-free summer for the Park District.
No, definitely not. And some quick other weather-related news here. You folks saw that thunderstorm yesterday. I think it was around 3 p.m.
Looked like nighttime. Yeah,
wild.
I was at the courthouse, right? As I usually am.
Yeah, I was at an appointment. I looked out the window. One tree looked like it was coming right at us. And then all of a sudden, the sky was black. Well, thousands, you know, went without power during that storm. 9,000 were still without power this morning. Hopefully that number has come way down by the time of this broadcast. But it also knocked a power line down at BP gas station in Berwyn. Now, the gas station at Ogden and Oak Park Avenues actually ended up exploding into flames.
That's crazy.
No one was hurt, however, so we're thankful for that. Let's steer the conversation over to Uptown and Edgewater. Residents, they're celebrating the reopening of their Red Line stations, Mac. So they've been under construction for like years, right?
Since 2021.
Oh,
they've
wow.
been under construction.
And just opening.
So these Red Line stations stretch about as long as my journalism career so far. So you could take that as you will. But Lawrence, Argyle, Berwyn, and Bryn Mawr Red Line stations now open. There was a grand unveiling with a ribbon cutting feature of the mayor. A lot of people rejoiced after years of minor inconveniences of having to walk to a temporary station across the street. I believe two of these stations were actually fully closed during that time. And this is a part of a $2 billion Red and Purple Line modernization project being pushed by the CTA, which is separate from the Red Line extension project. So a lot of improvements being slated for the Red Line, which has largely been knocked as maybe the least pleasant of the city train lines to ride. But so far, the reviews of these new Red Line stations have been very positive.
So they look good, too.
Yeah, they look great. They're bright for now, you know, until people trot all over them. Maybe we'll see how well they're maintained. But the room underneath a lot of these stations, they say they're going to leave to create new community spaces. So I'm excited to see what that turns into.
Nice. Well, Mayor Johnson unveiled another public transit priority this week, snuffing out smoking on the CTA. So have you all ever been on a train or a bus and someone, you know, pulls out that whatever they pull out, start smoking it. It's not happened to me.
It hasn't happened to me.
It actually has not happened to me.
Disgusting behavior that I can't describe.
You've seen other things. No, smoking's not something I've come across. What about you, Mac?
I've seen it. I take the train every day, pretty much, to here to hang out with you guys. I've definitely seen it. I feel like anecdotally, I've seen a little less recently, but this has been increasingly a problem since the pandemic really carved out the ridership on the CTA. Mm-hmm. We've seen a substantial dip in ridership during that time as the trains ran during the pandemic. And the numbers haven't really returned. So people on these emptied out train cars, I guess, feel more emboldened to spark up this or that or whatever.
That is bold. Just to whip out a cigarette and just light it on a train. Like, my mind is blown, but it happens.
Yeah.
I know it happens. People complain about it all the time, so it's happening.
And people complain that there isn't really a deterrence for it. You can pull the lighter out of your pocket and do it without any sort of sense of consequence. So now there's efforts around to fix that. Why this is happening right now, when I would say the problem was maybe worse a year ago, I'm not quite sure. But
so what's Mayor Johnson proposing?
Mayor Johnson is proposing increasing outreach services, mental health workers on the CTA trains. We're already seeing a couple of those programs being piloted for a couple of years. He's also calling through an executive action for a larger anti-smoking public awareness campaign. But this all flies directly in the face of Alderman Bill Conway, who has been a frequent foil, potential mayoral hopeful against Johnson. He says that we need a really substantial police crackdown on the CTA.
So he's pushing his own ordinance at the same time.
It's two sides. There's a softer meet people where they are approach versus a punitive approach. But if you go and you ask the CTA workers, which I've spoken to many of them, they don't think either of these ways are going to work, Sasha. They think that we need two-person train crews, so kind of like you see on the Metro, the guy going around taking tickets. They need someone monitoring and walking through the trains. That's the only way you can actually really deter this behavior. They need shorter train cars, less carts on the train, kind of so they're easily monitored. But the problem is that CTA still in many ways has a staffing shortage, which we saw during the pandemic.
Right.
They've frequently added service back in the last year as more workers have completed training and been onboarded. But it seems like these two-person crews, at least right now, seem to be almost a pipe dream given where they're at. Mm.
Yeah, so it sounds like we've got the two sides or the two visions for how to get this done. But is Alderman Conway at least now supporting the mayor's proposal?
No, he's out there saying, yeah, I don't like it.
Still pushing his way. On to another transportation update. Last Sunday, it was actually the busiest day ever at O'Hare. 116,000 travelers passed through the airport, and that broke the record of nearly 114,000 that was set less than a month ago. So it's just going up.
It's great, but I mean, there was a time old enough to remember when O'Hare was the busiest airport in the world, and it's—I think it's barely in the top ten now. But all due respect to Atlanta, Dallas, Fort Worth, Dubai—I don't know, Istanbul,
Denver,
Denver too. Yeah.
Oh man, NASCAR. It's passed on another race in the loop, so it's not coming back next year. They're heading west. They're taking their roadshow to San Diego. They said they might come to Chicago in the future. Dan is waving.
Bye, Felicia.
Dan is waving.
I mean, it's not my thing, you know. I'm not a car guy anyway.
I like cars.
There are NASCAR fans in the Chicago area.
A lot of them.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, is this really NASCAR country? And the people downtown seem, especially live downtown, those of us who work around here, it's annoying. I mean, that it's
tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, you know, there have been a lot of stories about, is it a great deal for us? Weather was bad a couple times, too, to be fair to them.
That's true.
It's every time, right?
Pouring rain every single time. Like a flood the first year, right?
Right. It's like somebody sending a message, right?
I mean, call me a Euro snob or something, but I think a Grand Prix would do better here.
Other sports news, Mac. I understand you attended a unique softball game recently. Tell us.
So Alder People versus City Cops, is that what we're talking about here, Sasha?
Yeah.
I did attend this as a person, not a reporter, for once in a while, because I was really just curious. I play 16-inch softball myself.
Hey, reporters are people, too.
Yeah, exactly. In the Chicago Media League, so well aware of the sport, the Alder People and the Cops played a game that I wouldn't really call a softball game at all. I think the learning curve is very substantial, to put it politely. The Chicago Cops batted from the opposite side of the box, so right-handers batted left-handers to try to even it out.
Okay.
They also gave the Alder People maybe 5 to 8 outs per inning to try to make it a little bit more even. The only Alder person who looked like they had ever played softball before was Alderman Scott Wagaspak, who said he'd donate $1,000 to charity for every home run hit during the game.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of shot himself in the foot because he hit a home run himself, so it might have been fun rounding the bases, but he was out of $1,000 more. After that, the Cops in a game kind of let the Alder People win. But if you're asking me, the talent disparity was very obvious.
There used to be reporters versus city council.
Should we bring that back in?
I think it hasn't been done in at least 20 years. Wow. And I think Rich Daley frowned upon it when he got into some scandal.
We'll keep it at Alderman.
remember correctly.
Alderman and Cops. Well, it sounds like fun, but I know that you also were following another baseball team that's taking their game very seriously. Tell us about Perfect Catch Chicago.
Yeah, these girls who play baseball would absolutely just wipe the floor of the Alder People. I'll say that right now. I'd pay for that as well. But Chicago has an all-girls baseball team, and now they have all-girls baseball teams, plural, because the former Humboldt Park Gators, which started as 5 girls playing baseball in the park, named after the park's most famous resident, the Chance the Snapper alligator. We don't need to go down that.
Right.
Can of worms here. Hopefully all your listeners know already. But
mm-hmm.
They've now grown to a program called Perfect Catch Chicago. And they brought 4 teams ages 18 to 12, I believe, to a national all-girls baseball tournament in Sparks, Nevada. The main team is led by a girl, Amira Hondras, who recently played in the Double Duty Classic, which is a All-Star game at Sox Park for black high school players from across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And she received an offer to play college baseball, too.
Wow.
On a men's team. So these girls are
amazing.
Very impressive. 5 of them played varsity CPS baseball this season. So, you know, baseball is a sport where your size really doesn't matter, Sasha. So these girls are fast, they're quick, they know how to get on base, and they're fitting in and they're thriving.
Baseball was good to me when I was younger. Yeah, because, again, the size matters. rounding out our baseball portion of the show, we got news this week that Wrigley Field would host the 2027 MLB All-Star Game. So that's pretty awesome news.
Oh, very cool.
Now, in sadder news, we reach the portion where we tend to sort of look back at what's been happening in the world of local news. And we want to send our thoughts out. And, you know, we're thinking about our colleagues over at the Tribune, because roughly 10% of the Chicago Tribune newsroom was laid off yesterday. Did you folks hear that news as
yeah,
well?
We did. Yeah.
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 So, you know, sad news. It just seems to be happening, you know, station after station and paper after paper, and it's a sign of the times.
It's been the sign of the times for too long, and one of the people that was laid off, the CHA reporter, I think her name is Lizzie Kane. I don't know her personally, but I have seen the byline and just had socialed one of her stories earlier this week where she exposed an ethics case against at the CHA against the wife of a very prominent city council member who's trying to become the head of the CHA. These are significant stories, and having fewer reporters to cover them is not good for any of us, including the competition.
Yeah. Big loss.
Big loss. We'll leave it there. My thanks to WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos, John Seidel of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Mac Lederman of Block Club Chicago. Thank you all.
Thank you, Sasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Linnea Dominic. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow it down. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, well, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around our city. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.